Well, we made it. We're to the part that you've all been waiting for, the end. Actually, we have two more chapters of Epiphany to go. This is a Christmas season, and I think we're just going to leave it at that. Merry Christmas, by the way, before we get started on this. I may have a few words to say after I've finished with chapter 32. Right now, it's off to chapter 31, where Dan is, well, he's on a road trip. Chapter 31. Hints of the gathering daybreak crept across the eastern sky when Dan Stevens pulled into his old church at Lodi. Despite being nearly 18 years since he left to go to Pomeroy, he knew the place like the back of his hand. Not much had changed. Hopefully the door would be unlocked, as it always had been, providing refuge to anyone who might have needed it. He decided to park on a side street a block and a half away, thinking that he would be less obvious in his presence to anyone intent on doing harm to the church. Thankfully, he had the foresight to wear his running shoes in case he needed a quick getaway. Other than the protest of a small dog, Dan's progress to a side door went unnoticed. A few twists and turns through various parts of the building eventually led him into the main sanctuary. It was just as he remembered it, the pews arcing around to face the main stage, the approaching dawn backlighting the stained glass windows looking out to the east. A brief glimmer of flashlight caught Dan off guard. He backed off, hoping to hide, but stumbled over a small obstacle behind him. Before he could utter a small curse, a voice commanded him to stay where he was. "You're at the end of the road, preacher," the voice growled. "You better hope that heaven's real. You're going to be there, or hell, real soon." A dark form yanked him to his feet. "Way I have it figured," the voice continued, "you'll be there inside of 10 minutes, tops." "Well, I say I finally have my man," Sheriff Pinkerman's voice chimed in. "You're a pretty fair piece away from where I saw your last saw your sorry ass, Stevens." Dan said nothing. Nothing would change. He was caught in a trap with little hope of escape. The sheriff grabbed Dan's shirt and shoved him along out of the sanctuary and into what Dan knew was the music room. Pinkerman shone a light directly into his face. "I want you to have a good look at me, boy. I'm going to be the last person you'll ever see. Have a real good look." Dan saw malice, but he also saw a glimmer of fear. There was a snap on the other side of the now closed door. "Got you both," the other boy said. "Both of you gonna die just like I did in my dear old mother." Sheriff Pinkerman's face paled. He dropped his flashlight and ran to the door, pounding on it and pleading to be let out. After about a minute, he slumped down, his back to the door. He sobbed uncontrollably. Dan went to console his former nemesis. "There's another way out," he told the lawman. "If it's still here, I know a way into the Undercroft." Dan stamped on the floor for half a minute before finding what he wanted under a rug in the middle of the room. Tearing away the rug, he uncovered a trap door. He took the sheriff's flashlight and illuminated the darkness underneath. "Looks like the ladder's still here," Dan observed. "Let's get out of here before that crazy son of yours decides to blow the place up with us in it." "It's no use," the sheriff sighed. Before Dan could react, Sheriff Pinkerman pulled his pistol from its holder, placed the muzzle under his chin, and pulled the trigger. Click. Not the explosion Dan expected, along with a spectacle of blood and brains decorating the wall behind the other man's head. Click. A second try yielded the same result. Click. As did a third. The sheriff slumped over, defeated. Dan attempted to encourage the sheriff to leave the room by way of the trap door, but to no avail. He pleaded, hoping to escape before hearing the explosion which would mark their doom. "Save yourself, Pastor," the sheriff told him. "My life ain't worth jack shit now anyway. If I live, I'm headed to jail. Don't you see, Pastor? Don't you see?" While the sheriff was wallowing in self-pity, Dan heard sirens approaching and noted that there was some sort of hubbub in the outer hall. A light appeared from the trap door leading from the Undercroft. A familiar head popped up and started to scold him. What made you think you could sneak off with my car and get away with it, Stevens? It was Beasley. Boys, they're in here, she shouted, coming to Dan's side. In seconds, the door to the music room was forced open. Several agents, including Barada, Cavallo, and Hamner, swarmed in to confront the sheriff and pull Dan to safety. You okay, Dan? James Hamner asked. I suppose so, but how? What? I'm confused. I prayed for a miracle. Now this? Agent Hamner laughed. Let's just say that we keep our feathers numbered for just such an occasion. We have a few loose ends to tie up. We'll debrief you later. Now you need to go with Beasley to recover her car. Dan and Beasley left the building, past a group of uniformed officers in the process of searching and cuffing the same man Dan had seen several times previously. I prayed that you would make it out safely, Beasley remarked when they strolled up to her car. I don't really understand this Jesus thing, but I do know that positive thoughts directed to someone you care for can help sometimes. She let her remark soak in for a moment before adding, Of course, having a tracking device on the car helps a lot, too. Dan's mouth flew open. You followed me? Well, technically it was Barada and Cavallo. I was just along for the ride. Beasley kissed Dan on the cheek before going to the passenger side of the car. We need to take you to the field office in Akron before I take you home, she told him when she got in. There'll be a debriefing before we release you. With any luck, you can be home this afternoon. He drove to where she instructed him to drive. The field office was on the second floor of what appeared to Dan to be just another office building of glass and steel. There were 3 hours of questioning by several different agents covering various aspects of what he had seen and heard in the past week. His last section was with James Hamner. I want to thank you for doing what you did, the agent started. That last bit was really stupid of you and could have cost you your life if it hadn't been for Beasley. She seems to have been my guardian angel, Dan remarked. Excuse me. I thought you were losing your faith to where you didn't believe in angels, Pastor. Well, Beasley helped get me some of my faith back. There's still some missing? Hamner asked. Still have some niggling doubts, Dan admitted. Most of it has to do with the rules imposed by others of my faith. I may have to study and perhaps change course. Well, God loves you no matter where you are in your faith journey. Dan wasn't sure who made that statement. Didn't matter who said it in the long run. It mattered that the statement stuck in his mind in the first place. The remainder of Dan's session with James Hamner was short and to the point. He was thanked for his assistance in resolving the string of church fires. Buddy Clark was arrested before he could initiate the fire in the church in Lodi. On his arrest, he admitted to setting the other fires under investigation, as well as the murder of his mother. A point was made at that meeting that there was a reward being offered for information leading to the arrest of the person responsible for the string of church fires. When he was offered the reward, Dan refused, asking that the reward money be distributed to the various churches affected by the arson. When they were finished, Agent Hamner walked Dan out of the interrogation room and into the reception area. Emily, Lizzie Elston, and Beasley were waiting for him. Emily scolded her husband for running off in the middle of the night without leaving word. Arrangements were made for Dan and Emily to drive Beasley's car back to Magnolia. Beasley would ride down with Lizzie, then presumably from there head back to her place in West Virginia. She loves you, you know, Emily stated when they were halfway between Akron and Magnolia. Who? He asked. Beasley, as if you didn't know, Emily informed him. She told me while you were looking after or talking with the other agents, she added. Dan sat silent for a few miles to digest what had just been told. You know that nothing went on between us, he finally said in his defense. I know that, she smiled. Emily stayed quiet for a few miles. You and I had the same problem for a while. You were losing your faith in God. I was losing my faith in you. I have it back, Dan stated. Beasley said you did, she responded. She believes that you had an epiphany while you were up in the mountain. Yes, I did. I realized that I was in the grand scheme of things and that God is in charge. I'm good to go back. I know, she said. I know. Chapter 32. Dan felt as if he had spent the next month giving depositions to the FBI and the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation. He developed a friendship with Eric Cavallo to Emily's slight annoyance. The agent confessed to his desire to strike up a romance with the pastor's wife to Dan's slight amusement. He managed to turn the tables a bit, managing to get Cavallo's ex-wife to at least talk with him again. She agreed to counseling, too. By Christmas, there was talk about reconciliation. James Hamner engaged Dan in a series of long talks off the record about spiritual matters. He managed to nudge Dan in a slightly different direction than he'd been going. At the end of the talks, Dan felt the need to be somewhere else, or at least to do something different. He promised himself and Emily that he would explore some possibilities at some point after the new year. Beasley stayed for a while with Lizzie Elston at the Blue and the Gray. Emily joined them from time to time, taking her children, well, just Grace and Hope. The boys were soon up to their necks in football, with her. Hope occasionally dropped little hints about her mommy and the new lady drawing the faces with each other. On Dan and Emily's anniversary weekend, Beasley attended services and came forward to be baptized. Bob Barada filled in some of the blank spaces having to do with the various acts of arson committed by Buddy Clark. Buddy was diagnosed with PTSD. His way of dealing with his past was to set fires. There was an element of hatred for his mother involved, as well as hatred for the man that he said was his father. Sheriff Pinkerman voluntarily gave up his post as sheriff. His involvement in at least the attempted arson of the church in Lodi left him open to numerous federal charges, charges which were not made due to the intervention of FBI agent James Hamner. Rebuilding the Magnolia Community Church went ahead at a great pace, thanks to some unusually good weather lasting into the first week of December. With the 3 weeks left to go before Christmas, construction at the Magnolia Community Church looked to be just about done. Due to details which had to be finished and the school board's reluctance to sponsor some of the traditional activities held at the church during the pre-Christmas season, most of the traditions were moved to other venues. The board did allow the Roman marketplace enactment at the school, but to view the living creche, one had to go to the church parking lot, where the exhibit was set out in front on the front steps of the new building. Most of Magnolia pitched in. Downtown was decked out in colorful lights, as were many of the houses. Glenn Michaels unofficially organized a tour of lights for the month of December, terminating at Zeke's Cafe, where visitors from out of town could enjoy a cup or two of hot cocoa before heading back home. The tour ended up being a moderate success, drawing people from as far away as Columbus. They were not disappointed. Except for a week of rain, weather was particularly mild between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Hope Stevens kept asking about snow. Dan kept pointing out to her that there didn't have to be snow for there to be Christmas. His answer didn't satisfy her, so she kept asking. On the morning of December 24th, Dan got up a little earlier than usual to head down to Zeke's for breakfast and to say a word or two on the radio about Magnolia Community Church and the season itself. Before he could get out of the house, Hope toddled down the stairs. He spent a few extra minutes to get her dressed to go with him. There weren't a lot of people at the cafe, understandable because of the holiday. Those few people who were in attendance enjoyed Dan's talk and were particularly taken with Dan's youngest daughter. Dan and Hope strolled out into a cold, clear morning, taking the long way home to visit the church. What Dan didn't say to anyone, not even to Emily, was that the construction supervisor and the county building inspector had been through the building the day before, declaring that it was ready for occupation. While they walked toward the building, Dan reached in his pocket to assure himself that he still had the key given to him the day before. Emily and the other children were waiting at the front door as Dan and Hope arrived. She gave him a scolding look as he walked up. "Can't get anything past you, can I?" Dan laughed as they mounted the steps to the entrance. "Well, Daddy called and told me that he talked with the building inspector just after the inspector left the church," Emily confessed. "He and Mom asked for us to wait for them. They're on their way." Dan inserted the brand new key into the door and waited for Emily's parents. They arrived in less than 2 minutes, along with an assortment of other people who just happened to find out what was going on. "I thought I was going to keep this quiet," Dan said to those assembled. "Since we seem to have been found out, maybe we can delay for a while longer to call some other folks over." A quick decision was made, and the official opening of the Magnolia Community Church, rebuilt, would be held at noon. There would be a quick prayer service followed by an open house. Word was relayed to Glenn at Zeke's Cafe. Most of the community was aware of the plan prior to the hastily organized event. The event seemed to be as quickly organized as the building of the church. When Dan and his family arrived at 11:45, there were chairs set up, a dais, and a red and white ribbon set up by the entrance. There were also a pair of easels set up near the dais, with yet-to-be-unveiled artwork waiting to be unveiled. Speeches were made, congratulations were passed, then both easels were uncovered. A gasp went through the audience when it was revealed that both easels had half of the honor wall each. This time, each of the newly restored plaques was accompanied with a laminated drawing of each honoree, drawn by the young woman Dan spotted in the crowd just as the walls were being revealed. Beasley smiled and winked at him, mouthing, "I'll explain later," to the very surprised pastor. He looked over to Emily. She was smiling like the cat that ate the canary, nodding her head to let him know that she was in on the surprise as well. The unveiling was followed by the ribbon cutting. After a pair of quick invocations by Dan and Emily, the doors opened and people streamed in. Dan planned to go in with the first wave of people to give them a personal guided tour of the facility. He was waylaid by Steve and Millie Mulligan, who had questions about the community Christmas dinner, which he already thought he had settled. What he didn't notice during the conversation was that the people going inside were carrying packages and were almost immediately employed in setting up Christmas decorations. To say the least, Dan was stunned when he finally made it through the front door. His mother-in-law was busily directing the efforts to prepare the church for Christmas Eve services. "You've always told me that God is love," Emily told him while hanging on his shoulder. "You don't need any more proof that he's alive than watching what's being done here this afternoon, do you?" He smiled and cried at the same time, bringing his wife closer to him. While the people of Magnolia continued their task of making the new building home. What was to be a short celebration lasted well into the cold winter night. Warm hearts don't seem to mind. Of course, they never did. And that's it. I broke up a little bit there toward the end. You probably noticed this is, you know, it's an emotional work, as was the first book that I wrote, Saving Magnolia. There was some emotion in there, and pardon me. I'm sure you'll pardon me for breaking up a little bit on that. That last paragraph again. The last paragraph and a half again. Let me try it again here. This time, a little bit better. He smiled and cried at the same time, bringing his wife closer to him while the people of Magnolia continued their task of making the new building home. What was to be a short celebration lasted well into the cold winter night. Warm hearts didn't seem to mind. Of course, they never did. And there you have it. That is actually, technically, that's a first draft of the book that we have there. I will be coming back next week. I've decided that I'm just going to go ahead and continue this. We'll be reading something else or writing something entirely for it. I'm thinking of doing one of the books from, or doing one of the stories, serializing one of the stories from the coin jar. I haven't decided whether or not it's going to be the Sudsy Waters story or the, it's going to be Sudsy Waters. I think you might appreciate that, although Now let me take that back. I think we're going to do this other story that I've got in mind from the coin jar. It's seasonally, it will be seasonally appropriate, and we'll be introducing some new characters. The story is oh, let's see, oh yes, the story is called "Goodbye to All That." It's a cute little thing that I wrote up after reading some headlines and reading about some people who have drifted over here to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you join us. During the meantime, it's been a pleasure. I hope to see you before too much longer. In the meantime, author B.D. Harrell will be seeing you.